This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
For every 5 nasal scents we have, dogs have 2,500.
Unexpected Elements from the BBC World Service. Search for Unexpected Elements wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Estás escuchando The Fifth Floor.
The Fifth Floor dinliyorsunuz. Bizimle kalın.
Tumya Ektay, The Fifth Floor, Farnak Amidi Sobat.
This is The Fifth Floor, at the heart of global storytelling with BBC journalists from all around the world. I'm your host, Farnak Amidi. Valentine's Day is coming up, so we are going to get a little romantic. First up, we have an Afghan love story. My colleague Alia Farzan of BBC Afghan Service left her home country of Afghanistan when the Taliban took over in 2021, leaving behind her friends, family, and everything she knew. But in life, you never know when love is just around the corner, as it was here in London where she met her husband and now father of her child. Alia, welcome to The Fifth Floor.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Farhana.
It's great to have you with us. So, you know, before I get to your love story, I don't think many people will know an awful lot about how dating and courting and finding a life partner is like in Afghanistan. Give us a picture.
So marriages are basically mostly arranged in my country. And dating or courting is something like a taboo. People nowadays, young people would date each other, but secretly.
In bigger cities, maybe in Kabul.
Yeah, definitely in bigger cities. And where people use smartphones, internet, they usually meet each other through online platforms. Then sometimes, rarely, it happens to be in real life as well. They have the chance to meet face to face. But still, it should be secretly. It's more like a taboo to go and sit in a restaurant or in a cafe. It's not allowed there. If we go to the marriages, so marriages are 100% arranged in Afghanistan. Even though people meet each other, they kind of build that relationship and they decide that we have come to the point that we want to get married. Still, families should be involved. And it's the families that they decide whether they can marry or no.
So how do they make that decision? Because it takes a lot of, like, investigation.
Yes.
They put their Sherlock Holmes hat on and go investigate.
The families or the couples. It's a lot of work. They have to, like, go house to houses to find a girl or a young lady, a suitable one for their son. They don't know the family. They just knock their door and say, do you have a sip of water? Or do you have chicken in here? Or maybe, can you spare a piece of bread? Obviously, Afghan people are very hospitable. They say that, yeah, come we in. Do have. Come in. And they will go to the house and say, oh, I'm really tired. Can I sit here? Maybe they point to a corner of the house and they say, yeah, you can sit here. And offer them tea or most of the time a meal. Maybe it's lunchtime, you know,
yeah.
Or maybe it's afternoon, a snack. And then they find out that this family has a young lady, a suitable one in the house. Then what happens? They don't say it straight away. They do the same process twice or three times or four times until they make sure that that lady is single. And they can't ask it straight away that, is your daughter single? They go a couple of times. Then they find out that the lady is single and capable of marriage and ready to marriage, actually. And then they tell their son that we have found a young lady for you. Are you going to marry her? And then he's going to say that, oh, is she beautiful? Is she tall? Is she educated? The skin is fair. Because it's a norm there, you should be fair.
Yeah.
And how is she doing? Or can she cook? Can she clean? When he's kind of convinced that this is the ideal person, then they go for the proposal.
So all throughout this, the future groom and the future bride don't meet each other?
No way. In 98% of the time, yeah. I've got 6 brothers, like 4 of them have married like this. they haven't seen their bride until engagement. They have been engaged and they have seen that, oh, how is she looking right now? Even if the boy said that, I want to see this lady and make sure, the woman cannot say that. I want to see that man.
Only the
man. Yeah, it's not accepted that, oh, your daughter want to see my son. She has to accept my son. You know, it's a proverb in my country that say the man does not have the beauty, or a man is not described by beauty, but the woman is.
There's nothing to look at.
even if the man say that I want to see this lady, and most of the time they won't accept it. And they say, wait until you're engaged. An engagement, you have to bring some religious people. They will like do the religious process, and they will kind of religiously they marry you to the girl or to the boy.
Yeah, so you will be able to sit next to each other and talk to each other.
Then your
mahramiyat.
Yeah, then your mahram, and you can talk to that person, or you can actually see that person, meet and know each other after they're married.
And that's why even breaking off an engagement can have a very heavy price for women, especially
because
a lot of times they are looked at, you've been stained,
yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. Most importantly, if you have done that religious process, then you're married.
Yeah.
You're not a single person anymore. So the breaking up is a whole process. It's basically divorce.
Take me to an Afghan wedding. What happens from a few days before or from a few weeks before until the wedding day?
Sadly, it begins with the groom borrowing a lot of money for the ceremonies. In most of the cases.
For the shirbaha.
For the shirbaha, for the expenses, for to buy gold.
Can you explain? So the shirbaha is the money that the husband has to pay to the bride's family?
Definitely. So the shirbaha is basically like a dowry. And the logic is that if you marry a woman into your house, that woman or that young lady will be kind of an assist for you. In most of the cases in Afghanistan, the newlywed bride is like a maid for the family. She will be helping with the household work, with cooking, with cleaning, with even looking after the elderly. So this is the logic that the parents say, we have raised this girl for you. We have spent a lot of money towards her clothing, towards her food, towards her education, towards her health. And we have actually made her into a grown-up woman. So when you are coming and taking this woman from us, it will cost you.
Yeah, exactly. It's
and a financial agreement.
Definitely. And in most of cases, the bride's father will tell this. It will cost you. I'm not going to marry her for free. You know, they will say. And in some cases, they say that if we take no shirbaha or no dowry, they won't like know the value of our daughter.
And they won't respect her as
definitely,
much.
Definitely, they won't respect her.
And these women, usually when they are in their parents' home, they are helping with everything. So once they leave,
it's another case.
Yeah, it's another damage to the family, because who is going to take care of the parents and the younger sisters and brothers? Who's going to clean and do the cooking and everything? Yeah. So you're paying for that, for the damage.
Yeah. If you're wealthy, they can give up to $50,000, like dollars. Mm. Or if they're not wealthy, they can maybe do a reasonable one, maybe for $5,000 or $6,000. So when they get this money, and most of the time the bride's father would spend it on the marriage. They will buy some golds, or they will buy some equipments for the newlywed house. So maybe some furniture, some dishes and some beddings or something else. But a lot of that money, they just spend it, you know. Sometimes I've seen people that they have gone to the Hajj pilgrimage using that money. Mm. Or in some cases, they have wed their son using that money.
Mm.
And then it's the ceremony. So we have got 3 to 4 in my side of the country to 7 celebrations in one wedding. Yeah. But mainly it's like 3. The henna night. Henna bandan.
Which is like a bachelorette party, a hendu.
Yeah.
It's definitely. Where the women gather and sing and dance and do henna.
Put the henna on the bride's hands. And actually. And the men's celebration, which is basically wedding. And also in some of, I think it's in all part of the country, after the marriage is over, the ceremony is over, they have got another party called Tarte Jam-i, it means a wrap-up party. The wrap-up party is basically when they are married, they've gone to their own house. And most of the time, they hold it in the newlywed house. Mm. Basically, it's the groom's house. Mm. And all of the people who have been invited to the other ceremonies, they will bring gifts to the newlywed. It's a good thing, I think, because kind of help them to build their new house or new home. And after they have done the wrap-up party, then all of the ceremonies are done. So yeah. It's a long
process. You can finally go and live your life.
Definitely.
Alia, you didn't do it this way. So how did you meet your husband, the lucky man?
The lucky man, yeah. I was lucky because I met him in BBC. We were colleagues. So the fact was that we were already colleagues when I was working in Kabul, but I had not had the chance to meet him in any way. Mm. We even didn't have a conversation through mobile phone or something. We were already colleagues working in one section. You know, I sometimes think that this was our fate to meet here and like get to know each other here. Yeah, we met here. We worked on a couple of projects with each other. Then I think that we liked each other. Then it was straightforward, actually. He just proposed to me that, Alia John, I want to get married to you. And I said that, it's too soon. I have to think about it. And then in the process, the same typical Afghan traditional, we had to tell our families about this. I told my family, and they say that you have to wait and you have to investigate that whether this person is really genuine or not. You have to think about this aspect, that aspect, blah, 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 blah. We have to do the investigation. We have to find your family in Kabul.
So they did.
Somehow they did.
Tell me, I would love to hear. This is like the best part of it.
So basically, because we were all colleagues, they somehow find the true colleagues. Mm. And they ask that, how is his personality? Does he drink? Does he smoke? Does he gamble? Does he go to the nightclubs or no?
Everything.
Everything, yeah. And because his family is living in Kabul and my family is living in the north of the country. And between my province and the capital, it's 10 hours by car. You know, it's a long journey and the roads are damaged and everything. So they basically wanted to go to Kabul, find his family, ask the neighbors, the friends, the families that how are these people? Because we are going to marry our sister to the family. But sadly, they couldn't because of the way, and at the time, it wasn't very safe. So we said that just cool down, please.
Just take our word.
Yeah.
He's good.
He's good, yeah. And instead, they insist me to do some investigation. Don't be hesitant.
Yeah. I'm a journalist. I can do my own investigation.
You can ask him directly instead of going all the way to Kabul and asking the neighbors that how is this person doing in London.
What if a neighbor is just bad person and doesn't like them?
Yeah, yeah.
And wants to make up stories. And that happens a lot.
It has happened a lot. Mm. Yeah, I have seen it in my families that they have kind of damaged the whole process because that person didn't like that one.
Or they wanted the girl for their own family.
Definitely,
that happens
a
lot.
Yeah. And also the same thing. My husband was kind of scared that maybe somebody destroys this, jeopardizes this. definitely. So even though we met here, we knew each other, we kind of liked each other, and we came up to the point that we wanted to marry, even though the families had to decide.
Yeah, you have to go through that protocol.
The process. Yeah, definitely. The thing was that we were here in London, but his sister was in Germany. My brother was also in Germany. They were living there. So they went to meet each other.
Aww.
You know, his sister went to my brother's house a couple of times saying that, can we propose to your sister? Can we propose to your sister? Until he said the yes.
He said the yes.
Yes, yeah.
You're like, I've said the yes way
already?
Before you. Okay, you guys go do your thing.
Yeah, the formality.
So tell me about your wedding. How was the wedding? Was it a traditional one? Did you have your wedding here or did you go to Afghanistan?
Oh, I went to Germany. Because We couldn't go to Afghanistan at the time. My husband could, but I couldn't because I had just came out of that country, so I didn't want to go there. So we went to Germany and had a mix of traditional and non-traditional wedding. I just had one ceremony. Can't say the Western because it wasn't that Western. So non-traditional wedding.
Did you have fun on your wedding day?
Yeah, definitely.
Did you dance a lot?
I danced a lot. Yeah. Breaking the laws.
You broke so many rules, Anya.
Yeah, I broke so many rules.
When you moved to London, when you had to leave Afghanistan in 2021, I remember that time.
Yeah.
I was in touch with you. And I remember it was a very difficult time for you, of course. I bet you never imagined that, you know, it would end up this way. You will fall in love and get married. Is it something you and your husband talk about, especially now that you have a little daughter, Shahnameh?
Shahnameh. Most of the time, we speak. And at the time, I've never imagined that I will go there and marry. You know, when I left the country, maybe I was in the airport and I was imagining that the life will be too tough for me. Because I'm heading to an unknown place all by myself. At the time, I didn't know that much language as well. I couldn't speak English. Thankfully, I had a couple of colleagues with me. They were the only support that I had, emotionally support. So I thought maybe it was it's going to be very difficult for me. I couldn't be able to go out of the house. Maybe I couldn't be able to find a job. I couldn't be able to do anything in that country. Maybe I get depressed and I die in this country. You know, it's the worst scenario that sometimes you think.
Catastrophizing.
When I came here, that when I see my surroundings, it wasn't that difficult. So I find my job here, and I met my husband here, and I said, let's get married. But it was a tough decision for me because I wanted to, work on my career. I wanted to, study here. But when I saw that he's the right man and I will be going to decide wisely, and I think if you choose the right person, so it's not gonna stop you there, so you can still work on your career, you can study, you can do other stuff as well as being married and committed.
Of course you work together, you build a life together.
It's not like
the traditional way that you have to stay home, and maybe things would be different if you lived in Afghanistan, but
it would be it would be different.
Well, best of luck, Alia Jan. It was amazing to hear your story.
You.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for asking me. I love to share this.
Of course, I love it when you come on the Fifth Floor.
Alia
Farzan from BBC Afghan Service. This is the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Sarah Trelevin, and for over a year, I've been working on one of the most complex stories I've ever covered.
There was somebody out there who was faking pregnancies.
I started, warning everybody. Every doula that I know.
It was fake.
No pregnancy.
And the deeper I dig, the more questions I unearth.
How long has she been doing this?
What does she have to gain from this?
From CBC and the BBC World Service, The Con, Caitlin's Baby.
It's a long story. Settle in.
Available now.
This is The Fifth Floor, and I'm Farna Kamidi. For many people, Valentine's Day is a time to go on a date with that special someone of yours. You put on your glad rags and spend some quality time with your partner. But what lengths would you go to actually make that date happen? Some women in Ukraine aren't even letting a war get in their way of seeing their husbands for a date. Ilona Khramluk from BBC Ukrainian has spoken to women who traveled for miles and miles to the front line for some quality time with their loved ones fighting in the war.
So in the first year of full-scale invasion, we had many marriages, actually. It was everybody went to marry and so on. But it's easy to explain, because if you have a boyfriend on front line and if something happened to him, you cannot obtain any information about him, and you will not be allowed to go to him if you are not in official marriages. That's why many people on first year of war, they got married so much. It was crazy. But then, as many people expected, more people want to divorce. I know that if to compare what was before full-scale invasion, we had 15% more divorces than we had before war. Mm. As we see that this divorce rate is became bigger and bigger. The reasons is that family are not united, and they are, some of them are abroad and some of them just on the front line, and it's not easy to come to the front line. And actually, if you even come to front line, it's not like pink romantic. The war changed people. The man could be traumatized so much and they just cannot be in relationships. I had, for example, such a woman in my article. She told me that she went to her husband on these dangerous dates, but after this, they divorced because they couldn't live together because he changed so much.
And relationships are hard work. You know, you have to invest time and energy for a relationship to last long. And some of these Ukrainian women are really doing that. They are taking long journeys to the front line to visit their husbands. Tell me about that.
Yes, many women live not near front line, obviously. And Ukraine is a big country, so it takes like 2 days sometimes for some women to go to their husbands.
And Ilona, how did you find these women?
I wanted to write something about how the war affects relationships in Ukraine, and I tried different angles. And then I understood that I have many women around me who go to the front line to their husband. It's just their routine, you know. Actually, we have on BBC very good instrument. It's a BBC participation form, and we share it in our social media and ask women if they want to share their stories, if we have among our readers such women. And actually, I was kind of shocked that I had many, many letters from women who wanted to speak. I even had some cases when women told me that they didn't want to share their stories, but their husbands had watched our form and said, like, you should write about us.
Oh, that's so cute.
Yeah.
So is this a common thing? And is it something that the wider society was aware of?
I think yes. But I mean, it's not like everywhere, you know, but every family have a member of the family who are on the front lines or some friends. So they know it. But I would not say that all women do this because it's dangerous to go. But there are many women who do this.
And one of these women is Oksana. And she's been to the front line many times. Tell me about her and her story.
Yeah, this is like my favorite story from this article. She was there multiple times. Yes, she didn't plan it, but she said when her husband went to the war, she felt very lonely. She felt like in the prison in her own room, you know. She felt very like devastated. And they only lived in a marriage for a year and a half. So, you know, it's like very short period of time. It was a bad event that happened. Her husband was wounded, but he still came home because they had funeral in their families. So he came there wounded to visit this funeral. And then she worried about him so much. So she went with him by train to Kharkiv. And that was her first date like this. And when she did this for the first time, then she did it for a second. And then, as she said, it was less and less fearful for her. She didn't feel fear anymore. She just wanted to be with her husband again and again.
Oh. And where was she staying?
Mostly you stay in some homes of residents, and there are many residents fled from such distant places, but they allow you to stay free in such houses. And as Oksana told me, that it was such an emotional moment, she said, when you are sleeping in somebody's house and you see all the pictures of other people on the walls, and you understand that it's somebody's lives which was ruined by war, and it's like very uncomfortable.
So is this kind of like an abandoned house?
As I understood, yes, as it's an abandoned house, or for example, some resident fled abroad or to another city, and they just allow other neighbors to allow other people to live in their house, for example, for military or for civilian people.
Such strange circumstances to go and visit your husband and spend some romantic time or one-on-one time together.
It's like very strange, romantic.
So what about the soldiers themselves? In theory, how much leave do they get during the year?
They can have up to 20 days of leave, but they also have additional 10 days if they have some unique family circumstances. Mm. But in practice, it's like war is unpredictable. It's not like workplace where you can plan all your leaves, like where you can go and so on. If you have a very bad situation on your area, the commander will not allow you to go and leave.
Another woman you spoke to was Natalia. What was her story?
Yeah, Natalia actually told me that it took her 2 days to come to her husband in Kramatorsk on east of Ukraine, and then was with him only 50 minutes.
Why 50 minutes only? What happened?
Because it was a big shelling in that area. So her husband just met her on the railway station and he said, like, it's too dangerous, so go home. And she went home, but as she said, she didn't regret it because she said, although it was only 50 minutes, they were the happiest.
You know, people say that dating in London is difficult and stressful. I'm just listening to these stories and these women and their commitment, and just imagine dating on the front line. That's a task. So one of the comments a few of these women made to you while you were doing this story was that they had never actually traveled to the east of the country before. What did they say about it? Why is that?
For me, it's not strange because, like, I myself never been on Donbass, for example. And it just, Ukraine is a very big country and they live in the western of Ukraine and this is east of Ukraine. And east of Ukraine, it's not like, you know, capital or something. It's not like very attractive to tourists, I guess. Mm. But they had to go there and they find the east of the country have very attractive places. Like very, they, for example, I received some pictures from one woman. I asked her, like, where did you go on dates in Slovyansk on the east of Ukraine? And she showed me the picture. She picture with the water, you know, it was like a beach. And she said, like, we went to the beach, like, here's a nice beach, like, I like it so much. And if you don't know the circumstances and where this picture was taken, you have no idea that it was taken even in Ukraine.
Thank you, Ilona Kharamluk from BBC Ukrainian. I'm Farinak Hamidi. The Fifth Floor team this week was
Alicia Joya
and
Caroline Ferguson.
You've been listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Sarah Trelevin, and for over a year, I've been working on one of the most complex stories I've ever covered.
There was somebody out there who was faking pregnancies.
I started, like, warning everybody. Every doula that I know.
It was fake.
No pregnancy.
And the deeper I dig, the more questions I unearth.
How long has she been doing this?
What does she have to gain from this?
From CBC and the BBC World Service, The Con, Caitlin's Baby.
It's a long story. Settle in.
Available now.